When people display blind obedience to a leader, religious or political, people on the outside of that relationship often begin to use the word cult. It is generally not said as a compliment. Our guest this hour has researched cults, both political and religious, and is able to make some comparisons and contrasts on a broad scale. Mao Zedong, the Nazis, Aum Shinrikyo in Japan, and Donald Trump all come under the scrutiny of Robert J. Lifton in his book Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry. Robert J. Lifton is a psychiatrist and historian and creator of a large body of work, more than 20 books, including a book on survivors of Hiroshima that won a National Book Award. Dr. Lifton's teaching posts have included Harvard, Yale, and Columbia, and he's our guest. Thank you for joining us. Robert J. Lifton, you with us?
I am. Do you hear me?
I do. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, I'm happy to be with you.
So this is far from your first time down this road. In fact, a good bit of this material has been published before, but this is a timely matter, it seems like, in the world today.
Yes, in a way, the book is not really all about Trump, although he enters it, but it is a Trump-era book in which issues of extremism, issues of reality, are very much with us on a day-to-day basis. So, yes, this covers a lot of material, a lot of work that I've done over a long period of time, but also has a lot of new commentary relevant to our present situation. And certainly we're all preoccupied with issues of reality that this book takes up.
Now, at one time, you write, you thought of political and religious cults differently. Are the distinctions a bit blurrier for you now?
They're not blurrier, they're clearer in that they merge more than we realize, so that if you look at Chinese thought reform, which is so-called brainwashing, it's political extremism, or you look at the Moonies cult or the Aum Shinrikyo cult, a fanatical cult in Japan I studied where they released sarin gas into Tokyo subway trains in 1995. These would seem to be very different groups, but it turns out that they have parallel psychological tendencies. And I call that parallel tendency cultism. For instance, the Chinese political extremism also is cultic, the cult of Mao Zedong, and the sense that he was the great guru for an entire large nation. And similarly, the cults that I talk about, such as Aum Shinrikyo or the Moonies, turn out to have a kind of political totalism, so they merge. And I have found that people have used my work about one to study the other, and the work extends from one to the other.
Well, you know, any of these systems, political or religious, need followers, which raises the question, are humans wired for extremism or cultism?
For the possibility of it. In terms of the relationship of the two, let me say that I was stunned when some young people who were struggling with American cults came to see me, or their parents brought them to see me, because they had discovered a chapter in my study of Chinese thought reform that seemed to apply completely to what they'd been through. And that was a very concrete example of the merging of the two psychologically. As to whether we're wired, I think we're not wired to belong to a cult and surrender ourselves to a guru. But we are creatures with a long period of dependency. You know, human beings are pretty slow to go out into the world. It takes some to their 20th, 30th, or 40th year, but childhood has to be protected by every set of parents. And that's different from many other animals or other creatures. And that long dependency period can enable people to require the kind of leader who satisfies that dependency. It doesn't mean we're wired for it. One could say we're wired for the possibility of it, but it's by no means our only path.
You label cult leaders mental predators. I mean, what are some of the current common characteristics of that predation?
Yes, I speak of mental predators, and what all mental predators have in common is that they seek to own reality. They claim reality, they put it forward, and they seek to own it, and then to subsume the rest of us to it, so that their reality becomes imposed on us. And here, it's interesting to look at, again, groups that seem so different. For instance, the political extremism of radical ideology like Chinese communism, on the one hand, or someone like Donald Trump, who has no clear ideology, on the other. They would seem to be as different as they could be. What they have in common is the impulse and need to claim ownership of reality, and that makes it dangerous. That's what mental predators do, and they then play upon the vulnerabilities of people who, through their own psychological needs or through various forms of coercion, become accessible to them as objects of that reality. And that's really a struggle in our society that never goes away.
Well, as you point out, too, they are not psychotic, but they do have a need that is fulfilled by the person who ends up being the leader of the cult. Our guest is Robert J. Lifton. He has written on cults for many years now and pulls some of his thoughts together in a new book called Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry. We'll talk more with Dr. Lifton. You can join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. And be patient. We'll get the interview. Few minutes. Right now, it's time for a break. Let's go to that break. Robert J. Lifton, our guest, will come back and talk more with him about losing reality in a minute 30. Robert, it appears to be common with cults to have an end-of-the-world belief, and it seems like nuclear weapons and changing climate and things like robots taking jobs makes the world culture today ripe for this.
Yes, absolutely. That idea of the world ending is the apocalyptic narrative, and it always includes not only the end of the world, but the reconstruction of the world in a pure spiritual form. And that narrative has been with us really since the beginning of recorded history. But with the occurrence of nuclear weapons, the narrative is increased, because nuclear weapons in themselves can do what in the past we thought only God could do, destroy the world. And some then psychologically assume that nuclear weapons can somehow save us and recreate the world, which is, of course, a dangerous kind of view. But the very fact of nuclear weapons, which are apocalyptic in their dimensions, increases apocalyptic thinking in general. And in that way, our world becomes more prone to apocalyptic thinking. In my work, there was, in a sense, extreme purification with apocalyptic thinking in groups so different as the Chinese communists, who saw the nuclear weapons as perhaps being used and leaving only a remnant of wonderfully convinced communists to reconstruct the world, political purification. Om Shinrikyo was a spiritual purification, so that the world would end and would be reconstructed with members of the cult who would purify it spiritually. And then the Nazis, whom we think of as a political movement, but had a wildly apocalyptic idea of their own, in which they would destroy the world and the present people who dominated it, which, according to their view, were Jews and others who didn't follow a Nordic idea, and then they would reconstitute the world as pure, purified biologically. So there's always that element of purification and destroying the world and then reconstructing the world. And in the case of the Nazis, that unfortunately became very literal and very genocidal.
You point out that you started your research on Mao Zedong's China in the mid-50s while McCarthyism was reaching its apex here. I mean, is there a lesson there to keeping our eyes open to our own behaviors while observing others?
Absolutely. So that in the mid-50s, when I was doing this work quite a long time ago, there was McCarthyism, as it was called at the time, in which various people were fired from their jobs, condemned, put on blacklists because they subscribed to the wrong magazine, and there was communist fear all through the country. So McCarthyism was a form of totalism or zealotry and had its own cultist tendencies right here in our own country. In that sense, we have to beware of looking at the world as the good us and the bad they. We have on our record examples of various forms of zealotry, and we're in the middle of one right now with Donald Trump.
All right, so this brings up a question, and then I want to relate back to Mao Zedong's China before we get into the Trump aspect of things, because it looks like there's a contrast with Stalinism, for example, and that the appeal, at least as Mao Zedong tried to give it to the people, was that it's not the leader's idea, but the people's idea.
Well, yes, Maoism differed from Soviet communism in various ways, and they both changed over time. But one important way was that in terms of the psychological process I discovered, the Soviet communists used brutal confession extraction methods, and they then brought about false trials and actual condemnation of various party members and others. The Chinese communists used these confession extraction methods, but extended them toward a process of re-education, of systematic criticism and self-criticism and confession, which was geared to changing their worldview and changing their identity. And that wasn't found to that extent at all in Soviet communism. What's interesting is, if one looks for the historical source of it, it seems to be in Confucianism, where, you know, it's an ancient Chinese philosophical movement, which there was great emphasis on criticism and self-criticism and bringing about changes through re-education. Unfortunately, the Chinese communists under Mao carried it through to a very great extreme, and they were exemplars. They were examples of a movement that sought to claim reality and came down hard on those who, in some ways, questioned their reality, seeing this as a problem in any such people who had those questions.
Robert J. Lifton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Losing Reality. About that period of questions, I'd never heard about the Hundred Flowers period in China, and this was an example where people did get to question the government, and to disastrous effect, it sounds like.
Yes. The Hundred Flowers movement was put forward. It was an ancient philosophical theme, let the hundred flowers bloom. And that meant let all ideas, however different and divergent, be expressed. But when that happened and various ideas were expressed, many of them turned out to be extremely critical of communism, of its methods, and really of its efforts to control people and to control their reality. The communist leaders were stunned by this kind of response, and they changed their tone and began to victimize those who had spoken out, despite their having invited them to do just that. Really, totalistic movements, cultist movements, cannot tolerate divergence from the reality that they put down.
But as you point out, the reality became apparent, even to the people who weren't paying much attention, that they were running out of things. You know, they just didn't have good supplies, shortages of basic goods. I mean, so I wonder if it was the post-Mao switch to a market economy needed to strengthen the control of the central government, so at least that reality of you don't have stuff wouldn't be there anymore?
Well, the movement toward what they called following the capitalist road was an effort to ignite the Chinese economy. It became a little contradictory in those post-Mao years until the present, because once you open things up economically, there's a certain amount of interaction that has to take place that's also given certain freedom. And that can be tolerated unless the freedom comes to include anything on the order of political criticism. So the Chinese regime has subjected its people to a kind of unstable equilibrium, a certain amount of added freedom in relationship to economic measures, but the slightest show of political questioning is hit very hard, and they still use thought reform, confession extraction, and other brutal forms.
Our guest again is Robert J. Lifton. He has written extensively on cults, both political and religious, and he brings the thoughts together in one book called Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry. You can join us on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Francis in Mount Shasta, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the exchange.
Greetings, and thank you for taking my call. I have some comment and question for the speaker.
Go ahead.
Okay, I've read some books, John Dean's Conservatives Without Conscience, another Robin Meyer's Stealing Jesus and Why the Christian Right is Wrong, Gunsler. I watch Stephen Colbert, which gets us into the Trumpian stuff. But it kind of amazes me that American fundamentalist Christianity tends to, I'd ask them a question, well, who would Jesus bomb if you're going to be militaristic? What about the compassion that seems to be a major theme in mainstream Christianity? And then you get into the serious hypocrisy that you get in fundamentalist Christianity, and my head spins, and it kind of drives me crazy. And I wondered if the gentleman would mind commenting.
Yes, I'd be happy to comment. I think what you're talking about is a very real issue: the struggle within religion to take one of two directions. Religion has really been put forward strongly for its compassion and its understanding of human suffering and its qualities of humanity in some kind of religious belief. But religion has also an opposite tendency of itself claiming reality and thereby becoming a kind of psychological or mental predator by demanding that everybody else follow that reality. So religion, like most other movements, can go either way. And I think it's up to all of us who are concerned with these issues to examine the religion or the politics that we may be part of to see whether it can move or we can contribute to its movement in a humane, life-enhancing direction, as opposed to a controlled effort at ownership of reality. And that's what much of this book is about.
Francis, thanks for the call. Let's move on to Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the exchange with Robert J. Lifton.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for your work, Mr. Lifton. I have a question about how this plays out today in gender identity politics, because I was really struck when you talked about the ownership of reality and subsuming others to it. And what I see happening in gender identity legislation across the country in 19 states so far and proposed for the Federal Equality Act, so-called Equality Act, that a person's biological sex, whether they're male or female, is determined by their gender identity, which can be declared at any time. And it sounds sort of innocuous, but children are being told that they can change their sex as young as in kindergarten. They're being taught this. And once a child has self-diagnosed as trans or a teenager, they can no longer, a psychologist can no longer question whether there's comorbid factors such as depression in the family or sexual abuse or alcoholism or whatever. And otherwise, it's considered conversion therapy. So the subsuming of reality, the biological reality is being eliminated in lieu of a person's subjective feeling about whether they're a man or woman or male or female. And I've also noticed that they use in this movement the what you've called thought-terminating cliches, which I'm quoting you, brief, highly reductive, mm-hmm. definitive-sounding phrases that become the start and finish of ideological analysis. So the word, the trope, trans women are women, no debate. You're not allowed to debate that. And if you do, you're called a TERF, which ends the discussion entirely. So I'm very concerned about this. Also,
all right, so what is the question, Vajra?
I would like to know if how his theories and insights relate to what's happening in gender politics, gender identity politics today. Is he up on that, and what would he like to comment on?
I'm not sure that I can give you a satisfactory answer. Of course, the biological gender of any of us is enormously important. I would say that powerful emotions that question our very biology and our gender are increasingly responded to. And I would be loath to make a rule that would say that we can't explore both, or that any absolute position needs to be taken. I do think if one looks at certain forms of behavior, such as gay behavior, homosexuality, and people seek same-sex relationships, I think there's some futility in pressing them through some form of psychotherapy back into a more conventional position. So insofar as my ideas come to bear on this issue, I think they would advocate that we take serious concern, of course, about our biology and our biological gender, but we recognize that there can be transgender experiences and same-sex attractions, and open up the human condition to its various possibilities.
Take another call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert J. Lifton.
Good morning. I haven't been here for a long time, but this subject is too close to my heart and to my experience. I started out with one question. I may have a second, if I may. The first one is this. The pre-patriarchal societal models were not built on the premise of you are wrong, you know, flesh is wrong, everything is, you need gods, you need redemption by way of God. You need redemption because you are a priori wrong, you know. So to what extent does the whole redemption foundation, which we're all living with, predestine or create an inclination of our psyche over thousands of years to become vulnerable to a guru, to redemption, to singular ideas, that from folk to whatever, right?
Well, to try to answer your question, yes, there can be versions of Christianity or versions of other religions that press upon you some sense of your own badness or evil, and then claim to be the vehicle for relieving you of that badness or evil. And of course, there's danger in that, and it harkens back to what I mentioned as the two potential directions of religion that are quite opposite in their manifestations. Yet I'm sure that there are some forms of Christianity in which redemption is an issue that nonetheless are open to human growth and can in various ways encourage it. So I would answer your question by...
Hang on, just a second. Dr. Lifton, I'm sorry, we're right up against a break. Let's finish the answer on the other side. The book is called Losing Reality. Back on the exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Psychiatrist and historian Robert J. Lifton is with us talking about cults, religious and political. He compares them in some older material and some new material as well in a new book called Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry. We got the phone lines lit up, and we even have to finish up an answer from a previous call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. He was asking about religion and the concept of wrongness and then redemption through that religion. You're just about to give the heart of the answer.
I'll cut my answer short by saying that, yes, redemption can be a real issue, but it may not be the redemption idea that's problematic so much as the totalistic tendency within the religious group. And I think there can be groups that seek redemption that are not totalistic and are not mental predators, and there can be those that are. That's, in a nutshell, my response to that point. It's an interesting question.
I keep coming back to where the idea comes from when people end up following a leader more or less blindly. It seems like in a lot of political cults anyway, the leader seems to be saying the thoughts in the heads of the followers. You know, I'm with you. I understand you. I feel you. I hear you. All that stuff.
Yes. The leader claims to embody every desire, every goal, every truth of the potential followers. And the leader takes on what we call charisma. And charisma is many things, but it can include some sort of promise of more than natural achievement, a promise of immortality, of some form of supernatural reality that can be obtained through following him or her. And that charisma and the attraction to the follower is crucial. The leader also promises high states, the experience of transcendence in following him or her. And that is underestimated in a society in which people are hungry for high states.
Let's take another call. Jacob in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert J. Lifton.
Hi, good morning. I have a comment and a question. I encountered this term hyper-religiosity, and it was actually in the DSM-3 or 4 textbook on defining schizophrenia. You know, but you think religions are good and being kind of hyper-religious is good, but if you were friends with someone and every third sentence was about how Jesus Christ is going to save your soul and you should reject Satan and all his minions, you have to, after a while, you have to say this person's not quite right in the head. Now, my question has to do with, we live in a Christian society. One of the most powerful movements in the last modern society is the evangelicals. They stress textualism of the gospel, particularly the New Testament. And if you read the New Testament, the last chapter, which is Revelations, it's kind of a really strange book that kind of sets up almost a cultish-like situation for Christians. So I wanted your guest to comment on the book of Revelations and how it's kind of influencing, you know, evangelicals and our political society today.
All right. Thanks for the question, Jacob.
Well, the book of Revelation has long been the source of apocalyptic visions. It's the heart of them, and it's embraced by those who claim to live in an apocalyptic vision. So what some readers, what some Christians would see as symbolic and representing efforts at purification and renewal is embraced in a literal way for its apocalyptic content. And when that happens, when the embrace of the details of Revelation, the idea of the world being destroyed and reconstituted spiritually, when that embrace is literal and one joins in the process, it becomes extremely dangerous. If it's seen as symbolic death and rebirth in a way that one revivifies life-enhancing tendencies, that's a different matter, but that's far from always the case.
But the idea that you can, you know, you can enhance the end of the world to make sure that this cleansing comes about is where things get into a really
absolutely
weird zone. And in fact, you say ancient rabbis spoke of this practice as forcing the end?
Yes. It turns out that the ancient rabbis debated whether it's right to join in the violence that one knows is necessary to precede the appearance of the Messiah. And the rabbis, in their wisdom, thought, no, that would be forcing the end. The whole sequence and timing should be God's decision. But there are some cultic leaders who have no such restraint. Om Shinrikyo, for instance, saw itself as becoming a military group in order to join in the apocalyptic narrative and help it to come about. So they were advocates of forcing the end, and of course that led to their criminal behavior in producing, however crude, biological and weapons of poison gas, and seeking nuclear weapons, which they were unsuccessful at, fortunately.
Another call here from Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, clearly, Jeffrey, you need to have this conversation maybe on a weekly basis. This is awesome. Thank you very much. You know, I think past this prologue, and it's really easy to look at the others, you know, the fundamentalists are the problem, we're all okay. And there's sort of two threads that I'm trying to pull through here. One is the science of eugenics, which in the 1920s was sort of the rational basis of a lot of our white nationalism that we still see, but we don't talk about it very much. And the other is the analogous corporatist view, and certainly the Nazis embodied both of these, looking back and wondering why we were so perturbed at their methodology, because it was our science that they were using. And those two things still pull through. You can see them in Trump, and you can see them in other things as well. So your comments would be appreciated.
Yes, genetics was a misbegotten movement in which there was the claim that we could improve the human race by controlling the whole process biologically. And we had all sorts of ideas in this country, and some of the German scientists who were to become Nazi professionals claimed that the Americans and the British are ahead of us at one point. But the difference was that we remained a democracy, however flawed, and could therefore end and remove those laws. But the Nazis, when they embraced them officially, carried them out literally, and much that happened in the way of mass murder on the part of the Nazis was in the name of their biological purification. And that's a very important emphasis that I try to make, because you can seek to purify in an extreme way in the name of science, as the Nazis did, in their case biology, as much as you can politically or spiritually, always with extreme purification that couldn't be more dangerous.
We have mentioned sort of in passing that you do get the Donald Trump in the book. I mean, did you always feel that his relationship with his followers met the definition of a cult, or did that evolve over time?
Well, it evolved over time, and I wouldn't dismiss the whole Trump movement as a cult. I would say that it has cultist tendencies that are really important to look at. And if you look at, if you watch his mass meetings, and there's a kind of back and forth chanting about building the wall, who'll build the wall, who'll pay for the wall, it's almost a pseudo-religious chant. And some of the core followers, whom we call loyal followers, have given themselves up to him and what they perceive as his charisma. But I also say a hopeful thing about this, that when followers of an extreme guru in this way are disappointed, when he can no longer seem to offer them what they need as followers, which is really filling their entire life with his virtue, when that no longer exists, they can turn on him, as I could witness with Om Shinrikyo, where very loyal followers who are absolute in their loyalty to Shoko Asahara, the guru, turned on him when he was exposed as a criminal, and they saw him as a false guru, and they were among his most extreme critics. That could happen to some, not all, some of Trump followers, and perhaps we're beginning to see a little bit of it. And Trump continues to, in a way, create that possibility by his violations of reality, which accrue and become consistently disturbing in ways that affect some of his followers and have already.
You have clogged the phone lines up, Dr. Lifton. Here's a call from Jim and Eugene. Welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. One of the things that when Trump was elected, I looked into was the claim that he was narcissistic, and I looked at it and realized that that can actually be a functioning situation for some people in some situations. But over time, as he's faced more adversity, it seems like he's become more embedded in that, in towards a narcissistic personality disorder. And that seems to fit really well with the narcissism seems to fit really well with the sort of absolutist, this is my way. As somebody was, as was said earlier, that he seems to divine what certain people are thinking. And as a side note, if I've noticed that he will come up with a idea, but it seems like that's been on, say, Breitbart for a few days, and he says, this is what I believe. And it's almost as if people say, wow, he's thinking just what I am. But my basic question is, we would think as somebody who was obsessive-compulsive had a disorder, and we wouldn't rile against it if it was in our leader, if they always were worried
well,
about
when hands-on. Those of us who have spoken out, including myself, about Trump's psychological issues that are dangerous, it's not a full diagnosis. But yes, many have emphasized, and rightly, I think, his narcissism. I have emphasized what I call his solipsism. And that simply means his creating reality only via his own self, taking in only what the self wishes and needs to take in, and ignoring all standards of reality on the part of others, or all standards of evidence. That form of solipsistic reality in the leader of a great country like the United States is dangerous in the extreme, and we see its danger. And yes, I think under the duress of potential impeachment and of increasing revelation of his violation of rules and laws and even criminality, he goes further in his solipsism and narcissism. He may even be unraveling. We can't be sure. We don't want to claim too much. He's not psychotic, and he can function with his manipulations of media even with these psychological tendencies, and that makes him very dangerous. On the other hand, we're not helpless. I see the impeachment effort as a source of regaining reality, because its effort is to discover and make clear real events and real issues, as opposed to the solipsism and narcissism that has created its own reality with Trump. And it's a struggle, and nobody can predict its exact outcome. But certainly our institutions, which are geared for reality, however imperfect they are, and those of us within the society who insist on claiming the real in everyday factual events, we can see hope in the future.
Well, there's a lot to take in the book. It's actually a fairly slender volume and a fairly fast read, but a lot of deep thinking about cults, political and religious, past and present, from Robert J. Lifton, psychiatrist, historian, and the author of Losing Reality, on cults, cultism, and the mindset of political and religious zealotry. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. That's it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We're on social media, on Facebook, and on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. The program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant from Southern Oregon University, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange. Take an umbrella with you, sunglasses too, and have a great day.